From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
In the past month, many senators have asked me about my judicial philosophy. Simple. Fidelity to the law. The task of a judge is not to make law, it is to apply the law. My personal and professional experiences help me to listen and understand, with the law always commanding the result in every case.
The historic confirmation hearings of Sonia Sotomayor have begun. Today, we'll play excerpts from the first day and speak with one of her former law clerks. We'll also examine the record of Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions. He's the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee and is leading the charge against Sotomayor becoming the nation's first Latina Supreme Court justice. 23 years ago, the Senate rejected his confirmation to the federal bench, in part because he called the NAACP and the ACLU un-American and communist-inspired. We'll also hear from an innocent man who spent 16 years behind bars, in part, he says, because Sotomayor refused to hear his appeal. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Confirmation hearings began Monday for Judge Sonia Sotomayor, President Obama's first nominee to the Supreme Court. During her opening statement, Sotomayor vowed a commitment to impartial justice.
Throughout my 17 years on the bench, I have witnessed the human consequences of my decisions. Those decisions have not been made to serve the interests of any one litigant, but always to serve the larger interest of impartial justice. In the past month, many senators have asked me about my judicial philosophy. Simple. Fidelity to the law. The task of a judge is not to make law, it is to apply the law.
If confirmed, Judge Sotomayor will become the nation's first Latino justice and also the only third female justice. We'll have more from her confirmation hearings for the rest of the broadcast. President Obama's nominated a rural Alabama physician to become the next Surgeon General. Dr. Regina Benjamin is founder of a Gulf Coast medical clinic that's been rebuilt twice following hurricanes, most recently Hurricane Katrina in 2005. She's known for treating patients even if they can't pay their bills. Benjamin appeared with Obama on Monday at the White House.
For years, I've worked to find resources to sustain a doctor's office that treats patients without health insurance or the ability to pay out of their pockets. It should not be this hard for doctors and other healthcare providers to care for their patients. It shouldn't be this expensive for Americans to get healthcare in this country. And Mr. President, thank you for putting healthcare reform at the top of your domestic agenda. My hope, if confirmed as Surgeon General, is to be America's doctor, America's family physician.
House Democrats, meanwhile, are expected to unveil health care reform legislation later today. On Monday, President Obama reportedly told Senate leaders he expects their version of a bill before the end of the week. Speaking at the White House, Obama vowed to pursue his health care agenda.
We are going to get this done. Inaction is not an option. And for those naysayers and cynics who think that this is not going to happen, don't bet against us. We are going to make this thing happen.
Obama's hoping to pass a health care bill before the congressional recess next month. In Afghanistan, a military helicopter carrying military contractors has been shot down in Helmand Province. At least six contractors died in the crash, the Taliban's claiming responsibility for the attack, which comes amidst a massive U.S. military assault in the area. Two U.S. Marines were also killed in Helmand Monday. The satellite network Al Jazeera is, meanwhile, reporting of a previously unknown so-called friendly fire attack in Afghanistan. According to Al Jazeera, three American soldiers were killed 2 months ago in a U.S. bombing in Kunar province. The soldiers' commanders had called in the attack on their outposts after it was overrun and seized by Taliban fighters, but U.S. warplanes failed to distinguish between their own forces and the Taliban. Honduran President Manuel Zelaya is threatening to end mediation talks with the coup government that overthrew him unless he's reinstated by the end of the week. Zelaya and the installed Honduran President Roberto Micheletti both visited Costa Rica for talks last Thursday. Costa Rican President Oscar Arias said he hopes to hold further meetings in the next 8 days. Speaking from Nicaragua, Zelaya issued an ultimatum calling on the coup regime to step down after the next round of talks. Meanwhile, new details are being revealed about American lobbyists that have been hired to support the coup. The New York Times reports the coup government has hired a public relations specialist with ties to former President Bill Clinton. The specialist, Bennett Ratcliffe, was part of the delegation that met in Costa Rica last Thursday. According to the New York Times, the delegation, including the installed Honduran President Micheletti, quote, rarely made a move without consulting Ratcliffe. An official close to the talk said Ratcliffe wrote or approved every proposal that was submitted at the meeting. Meanwhile, the Honduran branch of an influential Latin American business group has hired Lanny Davis, the former White House special counsel to President Clinton. Davis is leading a lobbying effort to muster support for the coup on Capitol Hill. The British government has suspended 5 arms export licenses to Israel following a review of how the Israeli military used British-supplied equipment during its 3-week assault on Gaza. The licenses were revoked under British rules banning arms exports that could be used for, quote, external aggression or internal repression. The licenses reportedly involve shipments to the Israeli Navy, which has killed Palestinian civilians in attacks off Gaza's shores. In a letter to the Israeli government, the British embassy stressed it's not imposing an arms embargo on Israel and that the license suspensions resulted greatly from pressure by lawmakers and human rights groups. Another 177 British arms export licenses remain in place. The suspensions mark the first by a foreign government against Israel over the Gaza attack. The Bush administration provided the decisive weaponry for the assault on Gaza, and the Obama administration's refused to take any punitive action. In other news from Britain, a public inquiry has begun into the 2003 torture of 10 Iraqi civilians, one of whom who died from beatings by British forces. The slain victim, Iraqi hotel worker Baha Moussa, suffered 93 injuries to his body. Moussa was 26. He was the father of 2 children. His wife had just died 2 months earlier of a brain tumor. On Monday, lawyers for Moussa's family showed footage documenting the first hours of the Iraqis' imprisonment. The footage shows the prisoners blindfolded as they were yelled at by British soldiers. Phil Shiner, an attorney for Moussa's family, called the previously unreleased video disgraceful.
I think a shocking video account of a snippet of what these men had to endure. But it's what's even more disgraceful is the cover-up behind it. You've known about this for 3 years and you weren't able to show it. I've seen it hundreds of times, but I've never been able to release it because I was under a strict undertaking.
The British government has already paid just under $6 million to settle the case and issued an official apology. But 6 soldiers were acquitted of any wrongdoing and 1 soldier was sentenced to just 1 year in prison. Back in the United States, the federal deficit has topped $1 trillion for the first time. On Monday, the Treasury Department said the deficit passed $94 billion last month. The Obama administration said it expects the deficit to reach over $1.8 trillion by the end of the year. The Financial Times is reporting the investment bank Goldman Sachs sold nearly $700 million in company stock right after the collapse of Lehman Brothers last September. The sales continued even as Goldman began receiving billions of dollars in government aid. The news comes as Goldman Sachs is expected to report today soaring profits of an estimated $2 billion. Goldman's stock value has soared 68% this year, and analysts predict it'll pay a total of $18 billion in compensation and benefits. And here in New York, a group of activists rallied outside the Mexican consulate Monday to protest the latest in the case of the slain American journalist Brad Will. Will was shot and killed on October 27, 2006, while covering the popular uprising in Oaxaca, Mexico. His own camera captured his shooting. Will's family and friends have criticized the Mexican government for charging Oaxaca activists with Will's murder instead of state police forces. Last week, a Mexican judge reportedly ruled that the activist, Juan Moreno, can be held indefinitely and that hearsay evidence can be used against him. Mark Reed, a friend of Brad Will, criticized Moreno's prosecution.
Juan Manuel Martinez Moreno, the man falsely accused of Brad's murder, is also a part of this movement, also a man of principle. That Brad's murder is being used to railroad a fellow political activist is the most profound insult to his memory. And it is not the first time that his death has been used in such a way.
Mark Reed speaking outside the Mexican consulate in New York. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As Judge Sonia Sotomayor's historic confirmation hearings continue into their second day, today we spend the hour discussing the history and record of the first Latina nominee to the Supreme Court. On Monday, the 19 members of the Senate Judiciary Committee debated Sotomayor's qualifications for a permanent seat on the nation's highest court. Democrats praised her extensive judicial experience and the story of her personal progression. They noted she's the most experienced nominee to the Supreme Court in a century, having served as both a federal trial and federal appellate judge, as well as both a prosecutor and a lawyer in private practice. Republicans, however, continued to paint Sotomayor as biased because of her personal background and activism. Despite their long list of concerns, however, Senator Lindsey Graham acknowledged, quote, unless you have a complete meltdown, you're going to get confirmed. At the end of Monday's hearing, Sotomayor told her life story and outlined her judicial philosophy in her opening statement.
The progression of my life has been uniquely American. My parents left Puerto Rico during World War II. I grew up in modest circumstances in a Bronx housing project. My father, a factory worker with a third grade education, passed away when I was 9 years old. On her own, my mother raised my brother and me. She taught us that the key to success in America is a good education. And she set the example, studying alongside my brother and me at our kitchen table so that she could become a registered nurse. We worked hard. I poured myself into my studies at Cardinal Spellman High School, earning scholarships to Princeton University and then Yale Law School, while my brother went on to medical school. Our achievements are due to the values that we learned as children, and they have continued to guide my life's endeavors. I try to pass on this legacy by serving as a mentor and friend to my many godchildren. And to students of all backgrounds. Over the past three decades, I have seen our judicial system from a number of different perspectives. As a big city prosecutor, as a corporate litigator, as a trial judge, and as an appellate judge. Throughout my 17 years on the bench, I have witnessed the human consequences of my decisions. Those decisions have not been made to serve the interests of any one litigant, but always to serve the larger interest of impartial justice. In the past month, many senators have asked me about my judicial philosophy. Simple. Fidelity to the law. The task of a judge is not to make law, it is to apply the law. And it is clear, I believe, that my record in two courts reflects my rigorous commitment to interpreting the Constitution according to its terms, interpreting statutes according to their terms and Congress's intent, and hewing faithfully to precedents established by the Supreme Court and by my circuit court. In each case I have heard, I have applied the law to the facts at hand. The process of judging is enhanced when the arguments and concerns of the parties to the litigation are understood and acknowledged. That is why I generally structure my opinions by setting out what the law requires and then explaining why a contrary position, sympathetic or not, is accepted or rejected. That is how I seek to strengthen both the rule of law and faith in the impartiality of our judicial system. My personal and professional experiences help me to listen and understand, with the law always commanding the result in every case. Since President Obama announced my nomination in May, I have received letters from people all over this country. Many tell a unique story of hope in spite of struggles. Each letter has deeply touched me. Each reflects a dream, a belief in the dream that led my parents to come to New York all those years ago. It is our Constitution that makes that dream possible. And I now seek the honor of upholding the Constitution as a justice on the Supreme Court.
Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor opening the case for her nomination to the Supreme Court. Judiciary Committee Chair Patrick Leahy called Sotomayor a, quote, careful and restrained judge and described her story as one in which all Americans can take pride. He also warned against prejudice and urged committee members to not demean or belittle, quote, this extraordinary woman or engage in partisan political attacks.
Those who break barriers often face the added burden of overcoming prejudice. And it's been true in the Supreme Court. Thurgood Marshall graduated first in his law school class. He was the lead counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He sat in the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. He served as the nation's top lawyer, the Solicitor General of the United States. He won a remarkable 29 out of 32 cases before the Supreme Court. But despite all of these qualifications and achievements, when he was before the Senate for his confirmation, he's asked questions designed to embarrass him, questions such as, are you prejudiced against the white people of the South? I hope that's a time of our past. The confirmation of Justice Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish American to be nominated to the High Court, was a struggle rife with anti-Semitism and charges that he was a radical. The commentary at that time included questions about the Jewish mind, now its operations are complicated by altruism. Likewise, the first Catholic nominee had overcome the argument that as a Catholic, he'd be dominated by the Pope. We're in a different era. And I would trust that all members of this committee here today will reject the efforts of partisans and outside pressure groups that sought to create a caricature of Judge Sotomayor while belittling her record and her achievements, her intelligence. Let no one demean this extraordinary woman, her excess, her understanding of the constitutional duties she's faithfully performed for the last 17 years. Now, unfortunately, some have sought to twist her words and her record and to engage in partisan political attacks. Ideological pressure groups began attacking her even before the president made his selection. They then stepped up their attacks by threatening Republican senators who do not oppose her. That's not the American way, and that should not be the Senate way.
In April, the Alabama Republican Jeff Sessions became the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee after Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter announced he'd be leaving the Republican Party to caucus with the Democrats. Well, at Monday's hearings, Sessions outlined his concerns over Sotomayor's nomination and criticized President Obama's call for empathy as a critical ingredient for a judge.
I'm afraid our system will only be further corrupted, I have to say, as a result of President Obama's views that in tough cases, the critical ingredient for a judge is, quote, the depth and breadth of one's empathy, close quote, as well as his words, quote, their broader vision of what America should be. Like the American people, I have watched this process for a number of years, and I fear that this empathy standard is another step down the road to a liberal, activist, results-oriented, relativistic world where laws lose their fixed meaning, unelected judges set policy, Americans are seen as members of separate groups rather than as simply Americans, where the constitutional limits on government power are ignored when politicians want to buy out private companies. So we've reached a fork in the road, I think, and there are stark differences. I want to be clear. I will not vote for, and no senator should vote for, an individual nominated by any president who is not fully committed to fairness and impartiality toward every person who appears before them. I will not vote for, and no senator should vote for, an individual nominated by any president who believes it is acceptable for a judge to allow their personal background, gender, prejudices, or sympathies to sway their decision in favor of or against parties before the court. In my view, such a philosophy is disqualifying. Such an approach to judging means that the umpire calling the game is not neutral, but instead feels empowered to favor one team over another. Call it empathy, call it prejudice, or call it sympathy, but whatever it is, it's not law. In truth, it's more akin to politics, and politics has no place in the courtroom. Some will respond, Judge Sotomayor would never say it's acceptable for a judge to display prejudice in a case. But I regret to say, Judge, that some of your statements that I'll outline seem to say that clearly. During a speech 15 years ago, Judge Sotomayor said, quote, I willingly accept we who judge must not deny the difference resulting from experience and heritage, but attempt continuously to judge when those opinions, sympathies, and prejudices are appropriate, close quote. And in that same speech, she said, quote, my experiences will affect the facts I choose to see. Having tried a lot of cases, that particular phrase bothers me. I expect every judge to see all the facts. So I think it's noteworthy that when asked about Judge Sotomayor's now famous statement that a wise Latina would come to a better conclusion than others, President Obama, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, and Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg declined to defend the substance of those remarks. They each assumed the nominee misspoke. But I don't think but the nominee did not misspeak. She is on record as making this statement at least five times over the course of a decade.
Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions will talk more about his record over the years in just a moment. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. But first, we'll be joined by the law clerk of Sonia Sotomayor when she was a Manhattan judge. And we'll be joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in the hearing room right now. Stay with us.
I've been down for far too long. Till my faith was nearly gone.
Music's part of generation.
I never knew somebody just like you.
Did you hear what the brother once said?
To be a friend I could call my own. Till I let go of a broken heart. I let go to an open heart. I let go of my broken dreams. I let go to the mystery. And I believe in the miracle. I believe in the spiritual. I believe in the one above. I believe in the one of love. And take one step closer to you. I just take one step closer to you.
Pink, featuring Michael Franti, One Step Closer. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined now by CUNY Law School professor Jenny Rivera. She's the founding director of the Center on Latino and Latina Rights and Equality. She served as a law clerk to Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor in 1993-94 when Sotomayor was a Manhattan federal court judge. From 1988 to 92, she was an associate counsel for the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, a national civil rights organization on whose board Sonia Sotomayor served for more than a decade. Jenny Rivera joins us from Washington, D.C., where she's been attending Sotomayor's confirmation hearing. And we're joined on the phone by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez, who is in the hearing room right now. Juan, let's go to you first. Describe the scene and what happened yesterday as well. You were right there.
Well, the reporters are filing in right now, Amy. It's a huge press corps, obviously, more than 200 reporters packed in. And yesterday it was standing room only in the hearing room in the Senate hard office, the hard office building. and a real sense of a historic moment, obviously, especially in terms of the Latino community. The White House apparently was very involved in orchestrating everything, even the photo opportunities. I spoke to several Congress members who were asked to be in the back, in the rows, immediately behind Sonia Sotomayor, so they would be caught by all the cameras, including the Bronx Congressman Jose Serrano, Brooklyn Congresswoman Nidia Velasquez, Senator Bob Menendez. All of them were prominently behind Sotomayor so that they could be caught by the cameras. Of course, in addition to all of her family that took up one whole row on one section of the hearing room.
Juan, what were you struck most by yesterday?
Well, clearly, I think the sense that, you know, even the Republicans are aware that despite whatever criticisms they may raise, as Lindsey Graham said at one point, unless you have a complete meltdown, you're going to be confirmed by the Senate. There's a sense of even among the Republicans that she will clearly be confirmed unless some outrageous situation develops within the hearing itself. And I think that while most of the Republicans seem to say that they would be centering on her judicial philosophy, my suspicion is that there will be attempts by some to attempt to raise the issue of Sotomayor's long-time membership on the board of directors of the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund and some of the controversial issues that PRELDEF raised. I would not be surprised if that occurred, although none of them mentioned that in their opening remarks. But I think that overall, what I was struck with was, I guess, by the sense of acknowledgement by several of the Republicans that this seemed to be, despite whatever questions they might raise, largely a fait accompli that she will be the next Supreme Court justice.
Jenny Rivera, you were there, too, in the courtroom, looking at the judge from a different perspective. You were her law clerk. Talk about that experience and also what it was like to be in the hearing room with your mentor, with the woman you worked for, who may now occupy one of the highest positions in the land, a Supreme Court justice.
Yes. Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me on the show. Well, it was an electric moment. You could really sense that this is historic, that this individual, I think Juan is right, that you could really feel in that room and sense from what was being said that even the Republicans were acknowledging the pull of history, the pull to her eventual confirmation. And it was really an exciting moment. I was also struck by the inability on the Republican side to really present anything that might be a real true obstacle or a hurdle to her confirmation. I mean, saying that all it takes is a meltdown isn't saying much. She's faced tough crowds, and I don't think there's going to be any meltdown. We certainly didn't see anything like that yesterday. But it was a magnificent moment. I will tell you, even on the street where people were waiting online. People came at the crack of dawn for those tickets, wanted to be in that room, wanted to see her, wanted to hear her, wanted to be part of what was going on. So it was really quite amazing. And I think we're all struck by, that we are probably weeks away from her joining the court.
Jenny, where were you when you heard that Judge Sotomayor had been nominated to be Supreme Court Justice?
I was home. I think I was listening to NPR. I was about to jump in the shower. And I started to yell. I started to cry. It was quite amazing. I think, you know, the fact that she was on the short list, many of us had great hopes and really hoped that President Obama and his team would realize what we all knew who have worked for her, who have known her for years, that she's an incredible candidate and would be a wonderful justice. But, you know, we've been disappointed in the past. Her name has been on that short list before for other presidents. And the Latino community has waited a very long time for this. So until you hear it, it's sort of not real.
Jenny, your response to the whole controversy over the wise Latina comment, I can only think that that will be the title of her autobiography someday.
Well, I'm optimistic we'll finally get a wise Latina on the Supreme Court. But my response to that is that I'm certainly not surprised that that has become sort of the mantra of the critics, because otherwise there's nothing really to attack. She has stellar credentials. She has an incredible record, incredible experience, and she is a moderate jurist. You're not going to find something in the opinions to attack her on, and so that's why, as Juan described, you heard that chant yesterday from the various Republicans about her inability to be impartial, and it was based on these comments that they say she's made over and over. But my reaction to it was, well, let me go read the whole statement. I heard some of it in the past. I said, let me reread the article itself, and let me see exactly what's in the paper. And it is, as I'm sure many of you already know, it is a document that reflects a judge who is being very thoughtful and very candid about that decision-making process, who's working through this incredibly tough question about how judges come to decisions, what is it that influences them, and I think very candidly recognizing that although we're very in these very early stages, because the reality is that we have yet to have a judicial branch that really is reflective and fully diverse, that we are only now beginning to see enough women and enough people of color in that judicial system to start really thinking about the impact that that has on our judiciary and on our legal system, but really grappling with the idea now that there are more people present, and what does that mean? And being very candid and saying what I think many people now acknowledge, which is that judges are human beings. Like all of us, they have been affected by their experiences, and they are the products of their histories and those life experiences. And they bring that into the courtroom. Of course, as she has said and as she acknowledged yesterday, she decides based on the law. And at the end of the day, what counts is the rule of law. But she acknowledges in those statements that she is influenced by who she is, what those experiences are, and that she works very hard for anything that's a prejudice not to influence her. Of course, she'll respond to those questions today if people believe that what she said yesterday is not enough, because I think yesterday she laid, she laid to rest the question of whether or not she's impartial and said, I have one judicial philosophy, and that is that I'm ruled by the fidelity to the law.
Juan Gonzalez, and you, Juan, you can jump off anytime you have to as you are in the hearing room right now. But yesterday there were some interruptions. I believe four people were arrested chanting against abortion. One of them, Norma McCorvey, who is the original Roe of Roe v. Wade, who has changed her position now against abortion. She interrupted Al Franken. Wasn't this his first major hearing as senator from Minnesota?
Yes, and of course, clearly it was a surprise to everyone, but it sort of was a reflection that that many of these hot-button social issues are still strongly divide the American people, and I think it was a reflection of that. But generally speaking, I think that there was a sense that this was an enormously historic moment, and I think also this whole issue of to what degree empathy the personal experiences of particular justices affect their ability to judge. I think at one point Senator Gillibrand attempted to raise the issue, although she was cut off because she was running out of time and she was about to introduce Sotomayor, that Antonin Scalia has mentioned in the past that when he hears immigration cases or when immigration cases come before him, he can't help but think of his own immigrant parents who came to this country, and that it affects him And when he's hearing immigration cases, and of course, some people have remarked that Justice Hugo Black had at one time was a member of the KKK, and had to, when he joined the Supreme Court, deal with the fact that he had previously been a KKK member, yet he turned out to be one of the most liberal justices on civil rights issues under the Warren Court. So that clearly every judge brings to the court their own life experience, but it's not necessarily a predictor of how they are going to then rule, although clearly it will inform their own experiences, will inform their interpretation of the law.
Jenny Rivera, what is Judge Sotomayor's position on abortion?
Well, I think if she chooses to answer that today, we'll find out.
What about her record over the years?
Well, she's never addressed that question directly in any case, so we don't have any judicial opinion regarding that. So we don't have a basis to draw a conclusion, and I've never had a conversation with her about the right to choose.
Can you talk about your experience with her? You were her law clerk. How long did you clerk for? And talk about who Sonia Sotomayor is, the judge, the woman, your boss.
Yeah. I worked with her from 93 to 94. It was her second year on the Southern District. And so it was a really amazing experience. She is a very hard worker. She's brilliant. She brings tremendous amount of experience to that courtroom. She really commands a courtroom. She has very high expectations for herself, and as I think we all know by now, she meets them. But she has very high expectations for everyone who works for her. So it was a wonderful experience in that way because it really pushed me to do my best, to always be certainly prepared for whatever questions she might have and to anticipate questions and anticipate what was going on in the courtroom or what questions might come up in a case. But she is really also a wonderful person to work with because she is very much concerned that the people who are working with her are having a positive experience, that they're enjoying the work, that they're finding it challenging. She likes to keep in touch with her former clerks to know how their life is going, to find out how their professional career is going, and she really is a wonderful person to be around. It's an amazing experience, actually, to be in the courtroom building with her because she is so gracious and so open to everyone. You know, everyone who sees her in that building knows her. She says good morning to people. She sees them in the cafeteria, and people acknowledge her, and she acknowledges them. So she's also very much in touch with the people around her. So in that way, it's really wonderful to observe her.
Any anecdotes you'd like to share about your experiences with Judge Sotomayor?
Well, I don't have any specific anecdotes. I think what's really interesting and amazing about her, despite, you know, the claims about her temperament and so forth, which I think are based more on, you know, these old stereotypes about what we expect of a woman who's intelligent and well-prepared. But I really was very taken by the fact that in her courtroom, someone who came in who was pro se, that is someone who did not have representation, was treated with the same respect and listened to as, you know, a law partner from a big law firm. So in that way, she levels out the playing field in the courtroom, although in the end, she sifts through those facts and applies the law to the facts. But I was very taken and really quite impressed by the fact that she was able to do that in her courtroom every day without blinking and without thinking twice about it. It's second nature to her.
I want to turn now to the record of Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, who's leading the charge against Judge Sotomayor. In Monday's hearing, Sessions warned of a, quote, brave new world where words have no true meaning and a judge is free to push his or her own political and social agenda. Well, Sessions has recently become the ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee after Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter left the Republican Party. Sessions' key position on the committee is remarkable considering his own history. 23 years ago, Sessions was in the seat of the nominee. President Ronald Reagan had nominated Jeff Sessions to be a U.S. District Judge in 1986. At that time, Reagan had already appointed some 200 judges throughout the federal system, and Republicans held the majority on the committee. But Sessions became only the second man in 50 years to not be recommended for confirmation. Two Republicans, including Arlen Specter, voted against him. His fellow senator from Alabama, Hal Heflin, also voted against him, citing, quote, reasonable doubts over Sessions' ability to be fair and impartial. Sessions once described the NAACP and American Civil Liberties Union as un-American and communist-inspired because they, quote, force civil rights down the throats of people. Critics also testified they had once heard Sessions say he admired the Ku Klux Klan. This is an archival news clip from 1986 with Bob Schieffer of CBS News reporting on the Senate's rejection of Sessions as a federal judge.
And the vote is 10 to 8 against him.
It was a rare occurrence at the Capitol. Only once before in the last 49 years had the Senate Judiciary Committee formally turned down a presidential nominee for the federal bench. In Mobile, Sessions was stoic.
The vote has been taken. The matter is over. I accept the vote of the Judiciary Committee and intend to continue with my work.
Sessions has been a controversial U.S. attorney in Alabama whom civil rights advocates have accused of being insensitive to blacks. The Liberal People for the American Way group launched an intense campaign to block him from becoming a federal judge. During the committee hearing, Sessions was accused repeatedly of making derogatory comments about civil rights groups, in some cases characterizing them as un-American and communist-inspired. He claimed the remarks had been taken out of context.
Sessions, at a minimum, was much too flippant with regard to matters relating to race. He joked about it. He made comments about it.
Yes, that was, well, Senator Joe Biden, now vice president, and that report from CBS, Bob Schieffer. Well, for more on Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, we're joined now from Washington, D.C. by Sarah Wildman, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect and a regular contributor to The New York Times and The Guardian of London opinion pages. In 2002, she wrote a critical profile of Sessions for The New Republic called Closed Sessions. Earlier this year, she wrote a piece for The British Guardian on Sessions' new role as ranking Republican in the Senate Judiciary Committee called Sessions' Checkered Past. Sarah Wildman, welcome to Democracy Now! What is Sessions' Checkered Past, if you could talk more about it?
Thanks for having me, Amy. Well, as you described, Sessions was a U.S. attorney in 1986 when Reagan appointed him to the U.S. District Court of Alabama. He, at the time, had been at the helm of a voting scandal in Alabama, where he had charged three civil rights leaders with voting fraud, that is, falsifying absentee ballots, you know, faking various voters. And after investigation, they were all acquitted. It was called the Marion Three. One of them, Albert Turner, had been an aide to Martin Luther King Jr. And that was sort of the tip of the iceberg about Jeff Sessions. What had happened was he had a history of both comments and actions that appeared to be racist, whether they were or not, is, you know, whether, you know, to speak to the former President Bush, I can't speak into his heart. But he had a history of comments. For example, he called the KKK something he had once admired, except then he learned that they were pot smokers. He used to say things that were jokes. He called a white civil rights lawyer a traitor to his race. He was said during his confirmation hearings to have called a black assistant attorney general, assistant attorney to the state of Alabama, boy, in a derogatory manner towards African Americans. After he was failed to be appointed, he then led another voting rights investigation, which was again overturned in the early 90s when he was the Attorney General of Alabama. He was again and again accused of looking into the voting fraud among blacks in the state, but not among whites. He was accused of not looking into the church burnings that crossed the state of Alabama in the early 90s. And all of these things led to a record which people have said at best was insensitive to race. In fact, the Senator Kennedy, who was on the Judiciary Committee at the time, as now, said he was grossly insensitive to race and he should not have been appointed. So this was the beginning of the problems for Sessions. And when I wrote the piece in 2002, we had just had a moment where Trent Lott had said that Strom Thurmond should have been more successful in his run for presidency in 1948, which of course was at the helm of a segregationist party. And it kind of cracked open what was left of segregationist Republican ideologies. And Sessions came up just behind Trent Lott as one of the more insensitive to race members of his party.
And yet he did become a senator.
And yet he did become senator. He did become attorney general first and then senator. And then as senator, I think what's most interesting is that while his record on race has not been, there's nothing really to talk about after the 80s and early 90s when he left, when he came to the national stage. What's interesting now, though, is that he's been at the helm of anti-immigration efforts. In fact, he has called any efforts towards amnesty terrorist assistance. He's been praised by some of the most far-right-wing groups, groups like FAIR, which have been called associated with white supremacists. And what's interesting about that is that, of course, I would in no way call Sessions a white supremacist. I'm not qualified to do so. I don't know what his affiliation is with that. But his association with that is far more connected than anything that Sotomayor has been connected towards in terms of ultra-liberal thinking. Sessions has been far more connected to everything extremely conservative, very anti-immigration, and has never repudiated those statements. In fact, he upheld the fact that he had said the NAACP was un-American and communist-inspired. He said that those things could be true depending on how you looked at the organizations and depending on what their positions were on foreign policy.
It's interesting. When he was attorney general, I remember covering him, what was it, something like 13 years ago. It was the time of the rash of church burnings, black church burnings across the South. Can you talk about what he did as attorney general, both in terms of continuing this issue of, quote, voter fraud, and then to the church burnings?
Well, he launched an investigation into absentee ballots in what's called the Black Belt of Alabama. Traditionally, Alabama had a very, very depressed black voter turnout, partly because voters hadn't been registered to vote. And in beginning in the 80s, that registration began to change, and you started to see up to 80% of voter turnout in the black counties, which are also traditionally quite poor. You also have an elderly population that has to vote absentee. And he began an investigation into those first in the 80s and then again in the early 90s. And what was striking to some of the reverends of the churches that had been victims of arson in the early 90s, this is 93, 94 we're talking about, was that they thought the FBI, prompted by Sessions, was looking more into allegations of voter fraud than they were into the church burnings. And they were not able to turn up incidences of voter fraud. In the 80s, 1.7 million votes were looked at, and 14 were allegedly tampered, and even those were not proved.
Juan, I don't know if you're still with us, but I was wondering if you could talk about the interaction. I know today, day number two for the confirmation hearing for Sonia Sotomayor, there should be some fireworks. I guess Juan has had to leave us. But let me put that question then to Jenny Rivera as we hear this review of the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Jeff Sessions, his role in these hearings.
Well, history has a strange way of working its way through. Someone who did not, as you mentioned, was not able to become a judge as a result of statements, as a result of apparent connections and so forth, and real concerns and doubts about his ability, not just to be impartial, but whether or not indeed he holds some racist ideology near and clear to his heart. So history is working its way through. He has said he will ask about her impartiality. He said he will not support anyone who apparently decides based on ethnic affinity and so forth. And the judge's record is very clear. She is a moderate judge. She's voted, in fact, with the majority of the Second Circuit, I think 95% of the time or so forth. We have one of the wonderful report by the Brennan Center on this, an empirical data set on this. So you're not going to find that in her record, so you're left with these statements, and she's been very clear that she decides based on the rule of law. Her affiliation with the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, you know, that attack on her sitting on that board for, I think it was 12 years, is, as I will say, as not only a member of our society, but as a lawyer, extremely troubling. You know, lawyers are encouraged to find a way to work, whether it's pro bono or otherwise, on issues that help people who are indigent, but help create access and help to level the playing field. And so those cases and the work of the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund has always been about access. So although I anticipate that there may very well be questions related to that work as well as her judicial record while on the bench, the reality is that that shouldn't be an obstacle, and we should view that, again, as we heard some of the senators mention yesterday, as part of what we as people in this country should take pride in, that this attorney at the beginning of her career did this pro bono with the hope that the cases would end up creating access. And indeed, I would argue that the laws that were used during that time, both federal and state, anticipated exactly that kind of litigation, work that was focusing on anti-discrimination cases, opening up not only the courtroom, but the franchise, our schools, and, you know, housing throughout the country to all people, but especially Latinos and Puerto Ricans who had been denied access for so long.
Jenny Rivera, I want to thank you for being with us, professor at the CUNY School
thank
of
you.
Law here in New York, founding director of its Center on Latino and Latina Rights and Equality, served as a law clerk for the Supreme Court nominee, Sonia Sotomayor. I also want to thank Sarah Wildman for being with us, senior correspondent for the American Prospect, regular contributor to the op-ed pages of The Guardian in London, The New York Times here in the United States, has written pieces on Jeff Sessions, the latest Jeff Sessions checkered past, and we will link to it at democracynow.org. When we come back, an interesting case of a man who's been freed after 16 years in prison. He was exonerated, and he blames Sonia Sotomayor for not taking up his appeal. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Puerto Rico, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with a former prisoner who once appeared before Judge Sonia Sotomayor in court. His name is Jeffrey Deskovic. At the age of 17, he was wrongfully convicted of murder and rape. He spent 16 years in prison until DNA evidence proved his innocence. In 1997, 9 years before his eventual release, he appealed his conviction to Judge Sonia Sotomayor in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The court dismissed his appeal without even considering his innocence claim, in part because of a technicality. Paperwork from his lawyer had arrived at the courthouse 4 days late. Jeffrey Deskovic joins us now in our firehouse studio. He recently wrote about Sotomayor for alternet.org. The piece is called Judge Sonia Sotomayor Denied My Appeal and I Spent 16 Years in Prison for a Crime I Didn't Commit. Jeffrey, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. Tell your story.
What was your reaction when you heard Judge Sotomayor was nominated to be the Supreme Court Justice?
I recognized the name. I mean, I wanted to double check on the paperwork. From there, I immediately thought about other people who would be similarly situated as I was, wrongfully convicted, whose case Judge Sotomayor would have a direct role in. I was concerned for them. I had a brief flashback of what putting procedure over innocence meant for me in terms of remaining incarcerated, missing births, deaths, weddings, the natural course of life, and just the general horror of prison. And I immediately thought that we're really being sold a bill of goods here. Judge Sotomayor is not empathetic. If she was, there would be no way you could square that with her ruling. I would just like to clarify that when I filed in federal court, that was in the court just below hers. The court clerk gave my attorney inaccurate information regarding the filing procedure because the law was unclear at that point regarding the filing procedure because the new law had been passed limiting state prisoners. They would have 1 year to file in federal court after being denied by their state's highest court. And in that petition, I had a very strong argument of innocence. DNA showed that semen found the victim didn't match me. I was also arguing that the police had violated my Fifth Amendment rights by the manner that they had interrogated me when I was 16 years old, which is how they managed to coerce the false confession out of me, which is the only evidence that they had. So the court, at the urging of then Westchester District Attorney candidate Jeanine Pirro, they ruled that I was late without even looking at my issues. I then appealed that ruling to Judge Sotomayor's courtroom, which was in 1999. My attorney advanced three arguments as to why Judge Sotomayor should overturn the procedural ruling. The first is that to uphold such a ruling would be to perpetuate a miscarriage of justice, which of course ties back to my innocence argument and the DNA. The second is that reversing the procedural ruling would open the door to more sophisticated DNA testing. Thirdly, that this was an error that was caused by the court clerk and not by myself and my attorney. In her opinion, which Judge Sotomayor signed, she said that she was unpersuaded that my position was unique and that my petition had substantial merit or that it was caused by the court clerk. She was unpersuaded that those three things should trump the fact that my petition arrived 4 days late. As a result of her ruling, I ultimately served 6 more years in prison wrongfully. Given that the U.S. Supreme Court agrees to hear only a small percentage of the cases that come in front of it, for all intents and purposes, that was my last appeal. When that decision came down, my lawyer moved to re-argue the case in front of Judge Sotomayor and her colleague, Rosemary Pooler, and that too was denied, and the U.S. Supreme Court did not grant me permission to appeal to them. That ruling, in effect, condemned me to continue to serve a life sentence for a crime that I was innocent of, that I had strong evidence that I was innocent of, that I was arguing that. Luckily for me, it only turned out to be an additional 6 years before further DNA testing not only reaffirmed my innocence, but I identified the real perpetrator who subsequently confessed and was sentenced for the crime.
Interestingly, tomorrow you're going to be at an event at St. Mary's Church in Harlem on 126th Street, along with the sister of Troy Davis. This is a case that is gaining tremendous attention. He is on death row right now. Talk briefly about why you're there at his case and how his case now actually relates to Judge Sotomayor.
Well, I've dedicated my life to battling wrongful convictions. I recognize Troy's case as being that of a wrongful conviction. 7 of 9 witnesses recanted. There's been 4 people that the alternative suspect has confessed to. There's, you know, pretty much almost universal acknowledgement of that except through the courts and the judges. The similarity between Mr. Davis's case and mine is that technicalities are preventing Mr. Davis from getting a ruling on the merits of his innocence. That ties into Judge Sotomayor because the U.S. Supreme Court has decided not to make a decision on his case until next term, and that means Judge Sotomayor.
It has just been put off until next term.
Yes. So that means that Judge Sotomayor will have a vote, a very important vote in that case.
If she is confirmed Supreme Court Justice.
Right. If she's confirmed. So my concern in what I mentioned before about other people wrongfully convicted, I don't have confidence in Judge Sotomayor that she is committed to correcting wrongful convictions at every turn, wherever the facts and law indicates that should happen, or that she'll step in when a quality legal argument is advanced that a trial is unfair, which goes to the matter of whether the verdict is reliable or not.
Finally, Jeffrey, how did you get the DNA test? How were you freed?
The Innocence Project agreed to take my case. They work to clear prisoners across the country where DNA testing can establish innocence. I was cleared because they stepped in, they took my case, they persuaded the local district attorney in Westchester to allow me to have the more sophisticated testing. They compared the DNA, which didn't match me, to the database, and it matched the real perpetrator. Again, it's really flukish, which is all the more serious as to what the judge's ruling was. I mean, if he had not committed an unrelated crime, then his DNA wouldn't have been in the database, and I still would have been in prison.
When were you released?
I was released September 20th, 2006. I would like to add that politics has trumped justice because I've been in numerous contact with the Senate Judiciary Committee, both the minority and the majority. I've sent them the decisions of Judge Sotomayor in my case. I expressed that I wanted to testify about the human impact of putting procedure over innocence and how that affected me and my family, wrongful convictions in general. And basically, I got the runaround, and I've been in further contact with Senator Sessions' office, Senator Leahy's office, after the witness list came out and it was obvious I had been omitted. And
we have 5 seconds.
I requested them to add me, and both offices gave me will not do it.
Jeffrey Zeskovic, I want to ask, thank you very much for being with us, and we will link to your article about your own experience at democracynow.org. You will be at St. Mary's in Harlem on Wednesday night. Democracy Now! Produced by Mark Berkshire, Fidel Caduceo, Armata Angeli, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.